Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, a podcast for those who are pathologically interested in history, critical theory, philosophy, aesthetics, or anything that may inform the modern world. This is our second part of the conversation about Assad haters' mistaken identity.
Have you read his defense of the book?
No, I mean, I've read the attack on the book.
Did you find the attack persuasive? I didn't.
No, I didn't find the attack persuasive.
I thought it was almost like the perfect... If I was Jacobin and I wanted to run a bad attack on the book, I would have read that one because it would have been easy to refute. Although, it seems like that's what the argument most people would make. Whereas, I almost think that cosmopolitanism is a better proxy than universalism. This book got me reading a whole lot of books on liberalism and identity. Also, our last discussion with Adorno did as well. So I'm reading Fukuyama's book, where Fukuyama also gets into similar impasses, but he's not an erasurist. It's hard to know what Fukuyama is. I think Fukuyama is in that tradition of like conservative liberals who have actually, I think he's a Democrat now. I know that during the Bush administration, he broke with the Republican Party. Maybe he's apolitical. I don't know. But Fukuyama talks a lot about this. And frankly, Fukuyama, because he uses the entirety of world history to talk about this. Like he refers to the Ottomans, and he's more of a historian, is much better at making some of the points that Hayter seems to want to. And the other book I'm reading on it is Appiah's book, The Lie That Binds, about how if you actually look at identity, it is always re-emerging and breaking down. But his answer to it isn't universalism, it's cosmopolitanism. Which I guess is a kind of universalism, but that's not an empty universal subject, though.
Like, no. But I think it's sort of deluded for more of for similar reasons, right? It's sort of, he also wants to, in some sense, remain completely neutral on questions of identity. His thought is just that, I mean, it's a sort of cafeteria model of identity. Not only can you take some and leave others, in some sense, being cosmopolitan is to like revel in just the fact that it's complicated, it doesn't make sense, traditions don't hold together, and that's fine, you know.
Right. Although it's funny because, you know, everyone always talks about the rootless cosmopolitans, right? You know, Parsis, right, and Jews. And Parsis in India, Jews everywhere else. They're the most identitarian people on the planet.
Yes.
Coming out of this from a knowledge of the Jewish background, and I increasingly see the Abrahamic universalism as having some core good in it. But I also don't think it gets you out of nationalism.
Yes.
I don't think these things are easily settled by that way. I mean, if we really wanted to get rid of identity, really, you almost have to adopt a hyper-libertarian ultra-individualism, where each individual forges their own identity completely, and not even like the cosmopolitan identity. It is a completely unique thing for each and every person. That seems both utopian and impossible, but also like more logically consistent.
Yes. Just to be clear about what the point we're making with reference to the possibility of Marxism specifically, the claim is not that, you know, Marxism is impossible because identity is, you know, you can't get beyond it or something like that. But the thought is, well, the only viable form of Marxism is one which like takes on this project of constructing not an entirely new identity, but an identity that somehow fuses existing elements into some kind of concrete universalism. That's the only way it can work.
AKA something like what the US actually did.
Yes.
I mean, like, yeah, the U.S. is a synthetic nationalism with a synthetic national religion that no one really believes in anymore. I mean, and I don't mean Christianity. I mean, like, the founding fathers literally developed all these, all these nationalist traditions on purpose, particularly after the Civil War, but also even George Washington then did, because they knew they needed something for people to buy into.
Yes. I mean, to say this is, of course, not to say that, like, we're tied to a very specific political formation, the nation state.
No, in fact, I think the nation state is like the worst political formation for what we want. But
yeah, exactly. But it's going to have to be some political, concrete political formation.
Well, I mean, you need an identity to glom onto. And if the if you and I have been talking about this actually for much longer than people even realize, when we started talking about symbolic kinship forever ago and are like trying to be dialectic about now, you know, I would now not use such Hegelian Marxist language because I'm getting used to speaking to normal people. And when I talk about systems, they get it. And when I talk about dialectics, their eyes glaze over and I'm talking about the same thing. So I might use systems theory language for this now. Or the contradictory, I would still use contradictions, but like the contradictory emergent logics that have unintended consequences to speak normal talk. That's what I don't think Hayter is completely dealing with. I mean, like, I think what Hayter is right about, he's really right about. Like, and I want to end off a little bit on this. Do you agree with him that not just that Afro-pessimism ends up being hyper supportive of the status quo, but if you extrapolate from it, there's some other Marxist politics that seem radical that are actually just as supportive of the status quo.
Yes. I mean, so are you thinking of sort of end-Nazi style stuff here?
Yeah, I am. Where, like, you basically, well, I don't think they totally support the status quo, but you basically think that the only way, and I am thinking maybe of accelerationism, where you just want to push everything till you have either a developmentalist singularity or you have a catastrophe.
So you're thinking of, like, accelerationism to me has been associated quite closely with, like, left social democracy.
Right.
Because of Sendzeck and Williams. But you're talking about people who are, like, actually accelerationists as opposed to social democrats who like technology.
Right. No, I mean, like, I don't mean like Williams and Shrinick and Lee Phillips, who I think are actually just I actually think they're really just developmentalist socialists who don't want to commit on Marx. Well, Lee Phillips will at least commit on Marxism, but I think Shrinick and Williams are actually like playing fast and loose so they can kind of claim to be a Marxist and kind of not. I mean, they make some good points. I mean, when they talk about some vagaries in Marxist terminology, like surplus population versus, you know, reserve army of labor and all that stuff. I mean, they're not wrong about that. But at the same token, there seems to be a lack of commitment to class politics, really, ultimately. Yeah.
I'm not sure the problem with accelerationism is exactly the same as the problem with Afro-pessimism.
No, right? And actually, what in notes is more what I'm thinking. The accelerationist catastrophism or impossibilism, that's another way to call it. Like, that is the where, like, we just push the status quo until the crisis happens and it all breaks and a bunch of people die, and because a bunch of people die, we'll be able to politically organize society in such a way we won't need democracy or any of that, and it'll be really easy to run society because it'll get a whole lot simpler because of all the death. And, I mean, and you would say no one believes that. Hell yeah, they do. I'd even include some groups who are not even that extreme but think you have to have world revolution all at once everywhere, or you have to support the status quo, usually Democrats, because since you can't have world revolution, you got to, like, maintain the ship. These are catastrophist fantasies, or they're apocalyptic. And the critique of Afro-pessimism is that apocalypticism gives you, like, unlike Afrocentrism, where it's chauvinism because it's really that the world was great, And it was suppressed somehow, which leads you to, well, if everything was so awesome, how did you get suppressed?
So just to interject for a bit, I agree with you that impossibilism is bad, but I think that Hayter's critique is not necessarily about the impossibilism, but the claim that reifying identity is like a special road to impossibilism.
Well, yeah. I mean, he would say it was bad. In Afro-pessimism, he's saying it's bad for the same reason we're saying the impossibilism is bad. That you end up supporting the status quo and shutting things to make, you know, even revolutionarily incremental changes down. Like,
right. So all I'm saying is that impossibilism is bad, and Haider, that we can acknowledge independently of Haider. Haider's contribution is to say that identity politics of this special kind takes you to impossibilism.
But the reason why it does is let's talk about why Afro-pessimism in Pacific does this, though, because he's being specific here, and that's why I was interested in why he didn't talk about Afrocentrism directly. Afro-pessimism takes the chauvinism that you would see in Afrocentrism and inverts it. It becomes, instead of like the minority, in this case the African minority, as the actually the unique and special culture that really going to save humanity, because they are humanity and everybody else is probably not fully human in the same way, it completely embraces the victimhood. So they are special because they are uniquely victimized in a trans-historical way, and the entire identity of the world is predicated on this one group being a victim forever. That gives you the same special status that Afrocentrism does, and gives you the same kind of special pleading. But instead of it being explicitly chauvinistic, it's explicitly victim. But now, and both things can exist together. You can see this in Zionism, which sees the Jew as the eternal exile, right? But also sees the Jew as the Jewish person as eternally moral. And you know, having been to some synagogues where Zionists are prevalent, I can tell you that happens a lot. Yeah. Where the Holocaust is a completely unique thing, and anti-Semitism has a totally unique character. And there are left groups even. I mean, Marxist humanists believe this, actually. That,
I mean, I think there are strands of it in Platypus as well, actually.
And I've always pointed out that, well, it is different than normal racism that sees people as subhuman, that the anti-Semitism sees people as both not fully belonging to subhuman, but also actually in charge. And I'm like, well, I see that. I have seen that in Mexico.
I'm not sure that's unique to anti-Semitism either.
No, it's not. That's what I'm saying. Like, that's not. I was talking to Doug Lane about this. I'm like, that's not unique to anti-Semitism. I see it in racial animosity towards the Chinese in Latin America. You see that with the Parsis in India.
Yes,
you do.
That's true.
Like, and yeah, yeah. Most people in the West don't know enough about India to know what I'm talking about, but you do. You know, I think you'll see it with Asians in the United States soon. Honestly, I know in some of the African American communities there's a ethnic tension towards Asians that is that way.
Oh yeah, I mean that goes back, right? Do the right thing and all the fucking griping about the Korean businessmen.
It's funny. I was thinking about this the other day. Spike Lee started off to be so unbelievably honest about racial tensions in America, and I found the Black Klansman to be so utterly dishonest that I couldn't deal with it. I do think, I mean, the other thing that I thought was interesting is there is a sort of pink shaded glasses that Haider's wearing. That's why I mentioned the book Settlers, which is the opposite of this, where,
yes,
you know, where it's like not just it's throwing out the baby with the bathwater, but like socialists are usually anti-racist. And I was like, yeah, but there are plenty of racist socialists. There were plenty of them. It was a struggle in the CPA. It was a struggle in the Communist Party. You know, like, at different times, different sides won. There are even times where, like, people were supporting segregation, you know, based off of anti-racism because of the national question. I mean, like, this isn't new. And so Haider's examples, I think, are... It's not like he's lying about them. He's not. But he's not dealing with them enough. And thus, they don't actually seem to prove what he wants to prove. And we're not quite, not quite sure what he's wanting to prove, except for reified identitarianism destroys solidarity. Yeah, and destroys solidarity. And, yes. And you and I both say, duh. Like, completely true.
I mean, the claim is, given all that Haider said, the thought is if he looks more carefully at his examples, he will categorize them, he will either romanticize them or categorize them as examples of bad faith. That's my prediction. If he looks at them closely enough.
Right, or at least some element of them is bad. Like
yeah.
Hampton, Newton, good. Cleaver, Carmichael, to a lesser degree, bad. Malcolm X, good. Farrakhan, bad. Amiri Baraka, not sure about. I mean, that's why I keep on going to Baraka chapter, because it's the one time where he goes through somebody who keeps on going back and forth, although he doesn't talk about where he ends up. Right, he makes it sound like Baraka was like a clean socialist by the end of it. If I'm remembering the book correctly, I read that chapter a while back ago. where that dialectic, and Baraka himself, when he would realize that some of it was bullshit and then go the other, like that didn't stop with Amiri Baraka. Like he'll quote something from the '70s and not talk about something Baraka said like in the '90s and 2000s. I mean, like, that's where we're at. A friend of mine was like, focus on the Afro-pessimism critique. And I'd love to, but that's actually only like 4 pages of the book. I'd love to talk about, I'd love a good history of the entire sweep of the CPUSA on racial issues. I don't think that exists. There are micro histories on parts of it. I'd love a good book on racial formation theory. Like, okay, and there are tons of those books, right? And Hyder quotes from them, but he doesn't. There, like, I would actually just say, instead of reading this book, you should probably read those books. Race Crafting is a good one. The 2 volumes of The Invention of the Right Waste by Allen are a good one. Abraham X. Kendi's Naked from the Start. What's that book? His history of the formation of anti-black racism in the transatlantic slave trade is really good. What's another good one? I mean, there's just tons you could read, but you should probably actually read the pure history and not, they're far more systemic. And with the CPUSA, there's not a good history of all that it was doing, because there was a pretty big gap between what the individual groups were doing and what the leadership was doing. Actually kind of similar to the DSA now. And like the DSA locals are all over the place politically, but like the national is very much like the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez / Jacobin, which aren't the same thing, but you know, you're in New York now. You're at like ground zero of that. What do you make of that, and why that milieu produced this book?
Well, I think that I'm actually warming less to the book as we talk, and I'm warming slightly more to the book as we talk, and maybe we can meet in the middle. but my thought, I'm beginning to see that, you know, a lot of people, the thing about this sort of New York milieu is that it's very American-centric. It's very focused on adopting certain kinds of rhetorical positions from the left in the past. And people are certainly keen to try to begin to reinvent the wheel, to try to, you know, come up with a canon or a set of texts or a set of arguments which are going to define their left-wing movement without very little kind of concrete backing. And I sort of see Jacobin's tendency to publish God knows how many articles a day.
Yeah, Hayter is not, I mean, just to be specific, Hayter did a lot of the arguing of this in Jacobin, but he actually is the editor of Viewpoint, which is sort of the more anarchisty / Althusserian.
Yeah, yeah. No, so this is a more general point. I mean, Viewpoint, there are connections here.
Oh, yeah. Right? Well, so there's like Viewpoint, M+1, even The Baffler, which has a longer history. What is it? Current Affairs,
yep.
Jacobin. They're all DSA adjacent to, I think, Viewpoint's the least and probably the most interesting. But I actually weirdly didn't feel like this was written for Viewpoint. I felt like it was written for Jacobin.
And this is a Jacobin piece, yeah.
And also, The Intercept and The Guardian loved it.
A lot of these books, a lot of the current affairs literature, which maybe we should read some of the Nathan Robbins and stuff.
No, please don't make me read Nathan Roberts. Anyway, go ahead.
No, it's I'm not because it's good. I just think it's instructive that a lot of these people want to reinvent the wheel, to make these points, which are not necessarily that, I mean, Hyder is a bit of an exception, not necessarily that novel, but have the effect of taking a bunch of convictions that people have in this area and kind of canonizing it, making it into like a position or a coherent argument.
Right.
You know, so lots of people think, oh, you know, hey, Malcolm X is kind of cool, you know, and let's post about him, or let's, you know, try and, talk about the Black Panthers and how great they were. And, you know, when a Republican says the Black Panthers were terrible, here's our little virtue signaling to show that they were actually good. You know, to me, that's the kind of inchoate intuition that gets, like, channeled into a book like this.
Right. Well, and I would actually say that Hader's smarter than that. I mean, he really is.
Yeah, that's true.
But he's writing to that audience.
Yes.
Like, that's the problem. That's why I said my issue with this book may be its genre, because I'm sure if I set – because I've been reading some other stuff by him. I'm sure if I set Hader down in front of us and we were talking to him, and maybe – hell, but maybe we can even try to. He would admit some of the things that we are critiquing. But he would be like, but that's not the purpose of this book, because I got to get people to think about what universalism would look like, even though he's not saying that. But like I said, I defended his selection because I don't think the people he was picking was thoughtless or even completely in bad faith. Although I did find it interesting that with the exception of the Panthers, most of the people he focused on were not Marxist. So,
I mean, if anything was in bad faith, it was not the selection, but the discussion.
Okay, so why do you feel that way? Like, I felt like – so what I couldn't tell was it superficial because Hader was trying to not deal with the elements that contradict the thesis, or was it superficial because he thought that going into any of those in this kind of book would have bogged the book down to the point that he couldn't make the point he wants to make? And ultimately, is there a difference between those two things?
So I'm happy to say that there isn't a difference. Two, I think Hader would definitely say, if confronted by the details, that those details were irrelevant. But the second thing you said was definitely, I'm sure, what he's telling himself, right? I would think that he would deny that the first thing you said. He would deny that the detailed discussion would undermine any of the points. You know, this is often the bargain these people make, right? You often see, you know, Matt Christman or Amber Lee Frost or any people like that who Hader is better than. You know, they say things like, "Well, here's a one sentence clever thing that
right.
I'm going to say, which ignores a lot of history." Right?
Well, it was funny that I was reading Amber A. Lee, and then I know a lot of people hate her, and they responded really negatively to an article she wrote in ways that I thought were just dumb.
Yes.
And actually weirdly classist in the sense that, like, they were aiming down even from people who were quote unquote workers. They were well off urban workers and unions. But when I heard about the larger context of other things she said, I realized, oh, these people have a reason to read her in bad faith.
No, absolutely. Bad faith maybe is not the best way to put it. I mean, I think he's wrong. That I don't necessarily want to, wrong is, again, maybe not even best. I think he's papering over the cracks.
Right. That's, so you think what I would say to this is the same thing I said about its inverse and opposite book, Settlers. which is a book that I hated when I first read it, and there are great critiques of it. There are also terrible critiques of it. And a lot of people who love that book don't really even know Sakai's actual politics. Because he's not a third worldist in the way that they think. He's definitely not. Because Jay Sakai actually talks about a lot of the kind of nationalism that Hader's criticizing. He calls it fascism. Like, just outright. So, but there's a sort of like hyper-selectivity to the bad faiths of white socialists in the past, you know, that actually is distorting. It's right. And this is almost the opposite. This is like, look at how unracist socialists were.
Yeah,
most of the time,
right.
Except when they weren't, but we're not going to talk about that. I mean, because there are times where Hader concedes it, but he just jumps over those points. It'll be a concession made and then dropped. Because I've always said, like, when people hate on the New Left, I completely understand where they're hating on. I think a lot of the hatred of it is actually correct. But when they're they forget why it came into being in the first place. Like, there was a reason why it came up. Right? Like, unions who are still, you know, de facto starting segregation and and the nationalist character in a lot of it, and, you know, like, those things were real. That wasn't made up. And I think, like, a lot of this, you know, this is my critique of a lot of this kind of book, where you say they're trying to invent a whole cloth. I say they're not trying to exactly, but they're glossing over the cracks in a way that actually glosses over how things got to where they were. And yes. I was talking about that in his use of Althusserian ideology.
Yes.
Here's where, because we haven't talked about that. You said that bothered you, and it bothered me too. What it bothered me is you could always avoid talking about why some of the racialism was motivated by things that actually happened to people and not just an ideology that they're unconsciously working under.
So I just to be clear about what I mean by inventing out of whole cloth, I don't mean that they're inventing the movements or even the sort of the optimistic take on the movements. I'm saying that the set of books and like the set of output is inventing like a view out of whole cloth. It's like putting Haida and these people into a certain tradition.
Right.
That's what's being invented.
And it's a tradition that's not real itself either.
Exactly.
That it is also an invented tradition.
Yes, yes. So the reason that, I mean, and partly you can kind of see this in how fast the stuff is coming out. That, you know, that people are working really hard to say, oh, we're socialists. Look, there's this body of socialist argumentation, you know.
Right.
We can point at this. Because for a lot of people, there wasn't any just about 10 years ago, from their point of view, anyway.
No, I mean, the only thing you had were a couple of anarchist rags. Like, you had Adbusters and Z-Mag and stuff like that. All that stuff is – Adbuster still exists, but all the rest of that is gone. And here's the thing. I think ultimately, in 10 years, are we going to feel the same way about this stuff? Like even people in the DSA think the DSA is going to have to split soon. That like these compromises are going to come to a head eventually, and these are people who are pro DSA who are telling me this. That they just don't see like the moment they sit down to actually write a real platform or program, and even try to clarify exactly what they think needs to be done with the Democrats, that it'll immediately split the party. I mean the organization, right? And you already have on the local level, you have purgings and counter purgings on the lines that Haider is complaining about, but you also have stuff like the DSA like treatment of R.L. Stevens, who was kind of a Pantherist, but not a nationalist in the sense that he, you know, why else would he join the DSA if he was a black nationalist? That would make no sense. And like they were having a law office investigate him. So the DSA is not – and again, like, I don't know that Haider is even in the DSA. I'm actually going to confirm some stuff before we release this so we can remove it if it's false. It's founding editor of Viewpoints Magazine. He was educated in California. He's a PhD candidate in history. Oh, yeah. So he's a PhD candidate writing a popular book. It's an interesting thing, though. He edited a book on the black radical tradition with – so – I don't think he's not an erasurist, so...
No, yeah.
But the fact that we weren't sure about that from this book, do you think so? Do you agree with me that it is slightly telling that you can't tell?
The issue is not that he is an erasurist.
No, he's clearly not, but... Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. Even in the book, I didn't get that reading either, but I could see how erasurists could use him.
Yeah, exactly. So the thought is, he's vague enough about what universalism means, that erasurism – I mean, my thought was I was using erasurism slightly broadly, less as like a specific view that identity can't be part of, you know, liberationist movements, more as a kind of highlighting a generic issue with Marxism, that Marxist politics generally is erasurist in the minimal sense that they don't know how to deal with identity.
Right. I mean, but then again, he may be a relationalist. I mean, there's this quote from the book. I'm actually looking up quotes I wrote down. I don't accept the holy trinity of race, gender, and class as identity categories. The idea of the Holy Spirit of identity, which takes three co-substantial divine forms, has no place in materialist analysis.
Well, there you are. I mean, but you might think that materialist analysis and materialist politics are two different things.
Right. I mean, he says some, I mean, here's the other thing. Hader says things I've said. So this is another thing I want to talk about, what I like about him. Like, he talks about intersectionality in critical race theory. He said when Crenshaw used it, it made perfect sense.
Yes.
And the way that it's been combined with other things. Now, he doesn't go into the history of standpoint epistemology, but the way it's been combined with other things actually inverted it from its original purpose. And, you remember my critique of Mark Fisher, where I said, you know, maybe throwing out all identity claims is also not going to work. Maybe you should just try to make intersectionality materialist again, you know. I got nowhere with that. I mean, I still sort of believe that. Like, I'm one of those people who doesn't, because I've actually said that I don't know that all identity, like, you and I both agree that we don't think communism is going to wipe out all the political tensions between groups.
Yes. And there's we shouldn't even think about that as some kind of reductio, right? Because from a conservative point of view, what you're saying sounds like, well, that shows that we shouldn't be communists.
Right. And where I'm actually saying, well, nothing's going to wipe that out except for other things that we don't know yet. Like, so most of the reviews of this book have been glowing. From Pop Matters to Guardian to The Intercept, which interestingly, again, all those are kind of lefty, socialist friendly, but they're really kind of left liberal venues, but they're not identitarian. The best review of it, I think, is by Brant Roberts on Marx and Philosophy Review of Books, because he actually says, like, he thinks. I'll read his conclusion because it's similar to mine. I'll read not the whole, through the last two paragraphs. Hader's insurgent universality is hardly different from the Marxist universality that pushed black revolutionaries such as Ami Cesare, Richard Wright, and Franz Fanon, to name only a few, either away from Marxism or to build a new politics away from universality as a whole. That Hader does not address the historical problem shows the potential issues that could arise under such universalism, i.e. what you and I exactly are saying. In response to the blind road of universality that was upheld by the Communist Party of France, Ami Cesare declared a universality it was rich with every particular. So it sounds like multiculturalism that we hold to modern liberalism now. One wonders what Hader's response would have been to Cesare and anyone else who would have critiqued this total negation of difference in dealing with the vast differences that both bind and separate the political work of particular movements in the U.S. and beyond. It is certain that the Combahee River Collective understood this logic, as one cannot imagine that they would have dropped their particular identities within the insurgent universality that Hader proposes, since they were clearly recognized oppressions they faced as black, lesbian, feminist. Despite these conclusive flaws, mistaken identity is refreshing and timely to answer the rupturing status quo which flows from within particular movements of our day. Hader's critique of liberal identity politics cuts through the fog that has been raised by opportunists who seek to divide popular movements. His insurgent universality could become a potential useful way of thinking through identity politics that seek to divide rather than reconstitute our movements into a larger program which demands for a better world for all of us.
Yes.
Only political practice and time will tell if insurgent universality has a theoretical strength to overcome its innate contradictions. I think that's pretty much what you're trying to say here, right? His universality is too broad, and he's not dealing with the historical divisions that emerged out of them.
Yes. But I certainly wouldn't say that only political practice will tell that insurgent universality. I mean, I would say that we can say more of, you know, I don't even think the way the review phrased it is almost, well, it's a good suggestion, but it remains to be seen whether it'll work in practice. My thought is that there may be some deeper issues with that.
Right. That it doesn't deal with the Adornian sentiment that identity is the earth form of ideology, and good luck.
Yes. Yes.
You know, even though that would seemingly support Hader's Althusserian thesis, right?
Yes.
But I mean, I do think that it does just skip over where this failed in the past. And
yep.
It's one of these times where it's right about what it's critiquing in the main, but completely self-blind to how what its answer may be endorsing what created the very thing it's critiquing in the first place.
Right. I mean, it's sort of an uneasy combination of an uncritical universality and a sort of concrete identity politics. It's kind of like, here's one thing, one aspect of what we liked, the socialist politics aims towards universality, class analysis is central, all this stuff. And here's another thing that we also think is important, that socialist movements are rooted in identity and have the rhetorical formations of identity. It just kind of glues them together.
Right.
Which is why we've been like flitting between, oh, is he erasure? Or, you know, the Jacobin critique, which is that he's just repeating another form of identity politics. I don't think either are true. But I think the reason we keep talking about them is because, yeah.
I mean, I think that review encapsulates the problem, is that the reason why we keep talking about them is he's not stating where the particular belongs. Because he's like saying, oh, this Holy Trinity doesn't belong materialist analysis. But he's also not saying that race isn't real. I mean, he is saying that race is socially constructed, but social constructions are real. I've always found interesting about the social construction of race theory, which is ubiquitous on the left and even most of the right now. And yet, what I actually have said, I don't think that gets you where you think it gets you. Like, like, it's socially constructed. Does that mean it doesn't exist? Social construction doesn't mean not a thing. Class is socially constructed. It's also fundamentally real.
The relations of production and, you know, forces of production are socially constructed. Obviously, I'm not saying that a steel mill isn't a steel mill, but a steel mill isn't a force of production without the associated set of practices.
No, otherwise it's just a building.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, and Hayter's not, the thing is, Hayter's not saying anything like that either, but I could definitely see that some of the people who like this book are. And maybe that's not on him, but it's on him that so many of his phrases can be read in both ways.
Yeah.
Like someone who's interested in black radicalism and its universalism, and someone who's also interested in you know, kind of getting rid of identity politics at a moment when other people are using identity in a very broad way. I'm thinking about uncivil agreements and stuff like that that talk about how all politics is identitarian. And yes. In a way I'm like, yeah, of course all politics is identitarian. That's not, we're using identity in two different meanings and flipping back and forth between them. Like, do you mean identitarian as in a community? Or do you mean identitarian as in race? Or do you mean identitarian as in both? Like, and a lot of liberal politics right now, even centrist liberal politics, they willy-nilly flip back and forth between definition one and definition two.
Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking about Vox doing this recently. Because, I mean, the Vox heads are also in some ways similar to Hayter. They're frustrated with the extremes of identity politics, but unlike Hayter, they don't want to say it's not real. And so they end up being even more mealy-mouthed because they're trying to have it both ways.
I mean, for the Vox people, identity is real, but it ultimately has to be taken out of the political sphere. It has to be neutralized.
Right. So, like, your identity grievance... And basically, they say, like, their idea is that if we address your real grievances, then it will neutralize your identity as a political force.
Yeah, that's right.
So your grievances are real. Once we've addressed them, shut up. I mean, that's not what they'd say. They're not that rude. But in a weird way, I keep on saying this, in a weird way, I find them to be more... They're more actually grappling with the question because they're closer to power. They're not in power either, but... They're closer to it. And so, like, these realities are more real. Like, trying to maintain a democratic coalition so that it can stay in power means that they have to both be particularist and universal, because they're hoping the particular demographic shifts of the country will enable them to have a universal subject and not become like Lebanon. You know?
I mean, it, to be fair, a lot of the DSA people and the socialist candidates are also dealing with this.
Yeah, because a lot of the mainstream Democrats are attributing and I suspect including Obama, are attributing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Salazar's success with Latino identity movements in New York.
Yes.
In fact, I know they are, because Vox said that explicitly.
And that's not completely wrong. You know, there is some element of that.
Right. But in the same sense, you know, I mean, you got into these, with Salazar in particular, not so much with Ocasio-Cortez. Ocasio-Cortez's problems is that every day she sounds more like a normal Democrat. Salazar's problems is like she tried to have her cake and eat it too with these identitarian politics and ended up like lying. Or maybe not lying, but unintentionally or self-narrativizing in a way that she later found out was false. It didn't end up discrediting her entirely, but it was kind of embarrassing.
It seems like the closer that people go to power, the more they have to deal with these issues and the more, you know, people end up disowning them. Not because, I mean, it's in some cases because they end up social Democrats or Democrats, but in many cases because, I don't know, like think the case of Tulsi Gabbard, because they end up more nationalistic than you expect them to.
The other weird thing, what I found particularly weird, and I don't know that this is true of Hader's individual politics, because I'm not quite sure we're giving him a fair swift to what his brand of that broad stream of the DSA actually is. Viewpoints magazine is not as accommodationist with the Democrats as even Jacobin is.
Yeah. No, I definitely don't want to say that. Yeah.
But at the same token, what are they actually advocating? I mean, like,
they're not independent enough. You could say that.
They're not independent enough for the reason Adam Proctor talks about his revolutionless revolution. He's not wrong about this, that like the third party barriers are almost insurmountable. Like structurally, they're almost insurmountable. But when I asked Michael Brooks, is your goal ultimately to split the Democrats? Because that would create a third party. The only way to really do it is to have something within. In the United States would be to have a party split, which is the only way it's happened in the past. Although it hasn't happened in 140 years. No, 150 years. It's been a long time. But how that has happened in the past is one party splits and dissolves, and then the spectrum moves, right? So you had the Whigs split and dissolve, and then you had the Republicans as a new coalition emerging out of that. And I'm like, is your goal to because I couldn't tell from the Ackerman program when they're like, well, in some cases we'll run on third parties, in some cases we'll run as Democrats. But I'm like, where? How? What's your strategy? Like, are we running into the Democrats to try to turn them into the Bernie Sanders socialist? Are we, is your goal to split the Democrats so you actually have a Marxist party or an actual, you know? Because the idea that the Democrats are some kind of bourgeois labor party, that's not even true. Like,
yeah. No,
so what do you do? And I don't know. I mean, I can tell you that one thing that worries me, Amog, is I'm out here in Utah and I'm in a pretty progressive city. Don't get me wrong. I mean, but our DSA here is like, it's just rebranded progressivism with a couple of wobblies and a few old Harringtonites involved.
Yeah.
Like, it's not even what Jacobin wants.
Yes.
And then I've been to other places where the DSA is like, where all these Marxist Leninist groups and Trotskyist groups and stuff liquidated into when they realized that they were wasting their life on a sect. And they're very radical, but they have no political pull, because those places are also more radical is where like the DSA is literally the only game in town.
Hmm. I mean, I think those two alternatives pretty much exhaust the field. I mean, in New York, it's a bit different because the existence of universities and the publishing industry and the New School, very weird institution, makes all these things. I mean, kind of artificially inflates a certain kind of armchair radicalism. So there's a lot of chatter about all kinds of different shades of red, but in effect, the real politically effective movements here are, you know, people who are sort of left-wing Democrats in the end. So there's a lot of heat out of New York, and there's a lot of noise. But in the end, I think that, I mean, except in terms of pure numbers, on the ground, the DSA is sort of a slightly more powerful version of the second alternative you mentioned, where it's, you know. Or the first alternative, you know, so the people who are basically progressives who are happy to call themselves socialists, but not really obvious what that means on the ground. You know, and of course, so for instance, the ISO has a presence here, and there's various other people have big presence here. But the reason that's even prominent is because you're in university context, which fucks things up, right?
Right. Well, I mean, like, ISO is on every campus in the country, so and so is SALT. But
yes, but that doesn't mean they're politically effective.
They're not politically viable at all. And in some cases, they'll even admit that. Like, you know, when I was in New Orleans, there's an ISO group, but it's like four people. I mean, and so and they're pretty much all they're all university students except for like one old dude. Like there's one old dude and four university students who show up to the and they're really actually parasitic on the DSA because they basically what they do is they show up and troll it, right? I mean that's all they really do because there's not even enough of them to like march. And with SALT, you can't tell when SALT like went from opposing DSA to endorsing it, and then you have all these Trotskyist groups who used to oppose the DSA but have now joined. So, you know, it's interesting, and I guess maybe this book is a good way to talk about that. It's interesting because it's unclear what that even means. Like, when you tell me you're a member of the DSA, I don't know that I know anything about you, except maybe you're okay with some money that you have going to Democrats. But you pay, I mean, when I pushed someone about this who, like, because it was radically anti-Democrat, right? And they were in Tampa. And they said, but it's only $17 of my money going to that. A year, and only part of that's going to the Democrats, so maybe they're getting a dollar from me. And I was like, so what exactly is all this about exactly? And then they told me that they got the city of Orlando to you know, their Democratic caucus to endorse Medicare for All. And I was like, everybody's endorsing Medicare for All, but every Democrat defines it differently. Like Vox endorses Medicare for All, but they actually explicitly state that they mean something completely different than Bernie Sanders does. Bernie Sanders doesn't just mean single payer. He means single payers without deductibles and copays and all that. I mean, like, I don't know, man. I don't want to say an America with Medicare for All of almost any variety would be worse than America without one. Although I'm still not convinced Obamacare is actually going to ultimately have been better than nothing.
Yeah, no, that's an open question. I mean, it just moved a few people into the insurance system, and right.
The insurance system got better for poor people, which I guess is a net good. But it actually kind of got the policies available to the majority of Americans actually got worse. So,
the Medicaid expansion was unambiguously a good thing.
I think. Right, but not every state had to take it.
Yes.
So.
But that was because of the Republican.
Right, but that was, like, everybody could have seen that coming. I was actually surprised that Roberts held what he held, because, honestly, I thought Roberts' compromise, put a poison pill into Obamacare. There was already a poison pill in Obamacare, the second one. And B, because it made it shittier in red states. So, of course, they're not going to like it, because it was going to disproportionately hurt the middle class and wasn't going to help the poor people nearly as much. And B... was actually legally unprincipled. Yeah, I really don't know. Like, I've already said, like, constitutionally you can mandate a tax, but you can't mandate someone buy a service. And they said, well, insurance. I'm like, but insurance is a state issue, not a federal one. And so the constitutional limits are different. So the compromise, I actually think the compromise Roberts did that a lot of Democrats are still like happy about. I'm like, that was totally legally unprincipled, but. Whatever. I don't want to bring up Supreme Court stuff because it's gonna make people upset. Everyone's all weird right now. But yeah, let's talk about this. You know what? I think you and I are gonna have to stay talking about identity, my friend. I don't think we're gonna get away with this one for a while, because I think this people are gonna come to us and say, like, well, what do you actually believe if you're gonna be so hard on hater? And we're gonna be like, well, we're not actually saying hater's that bad, we're just saying it's not being nuanced enough.
Like, you got to start from here. I mean, you know what? I think I will actually recommend this book.
No, I think it's a good book. But you need to know what it is.
Yeah.
If you take it as the most insightful reading of identity politics, you know, like that kind of stuff that you're hearing, that's a joke.
It's not. It's not. It's step one.
And frankly, it's also not the first book to say this. On the spectrum of politics at this moment, there are 10 books on this very topic that came out right now.
which say, I mean, not exactly the same thing, but stuff that's not terribly different.
No, I mean, everyone from Fukuyama to Appia to a bunch of sociologists. Oh,
that's what you were. I thought you were thinking about the sort of DSA left.
No. I'm talking about the fact that this identity stuff. It seems that this is a problem is transparent to all political tendencies right now, except for weirdly conventional Republicans who normally gripe about this constantly, but have recently shut up about it because.
Well, they like it now. It's working for them.
Right. So, but you have the entire spectrum of liberal opinion saying maybe this identity politics stuff has gone too far.
Yes.
From conservative-ishy, but democratic adjacent liberals like Fukuyama, all the way to Hayter, and I'm probably sure we're going to see people to the left of him write similar books.
I tell you what, let's say what we have to conclude on Hayter, and then we can read these other books.
All right, so conclusion with Hayter. Read it, but what I'm going to tell everyone to do is after you read everything he cites to get a fuller picture of what he's actually talking about. And in addition, read some books on the history of race formation and not just these political books. Like, read some books, read The Invention of the Right Race, read Racecraft, read... what is it? The Abraham Al-Kendi book, Something from the Start. I can't remember what the first word. And they're not all Marxist-y. Some of them are, some of them aren't. But read them, because I think if you look at that historically, this book will, like, what the virtues of this book will be apparent, but so will the flaws. And so, but I'd say overall, I'd give it a 70. Not a 70. I'd give it like a 78, maybe an 82. Yeah, I'd be like. Like, it's incredibly readable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a good book.
It's enjoyable. It's just not what... You know what it reminds me of? We talked about Chapo, but you know what it really reminds me of? Corey Robbins, his book on the reactionary mind, which I had similar problems with, that I was like, oh, this is highly selective, and you're ignoring all the counter cases and stuff that don't fit your thesis, and that seems deliberate.
But the broad thrust is right, and it seems making the right point.
Yeah, well, I will say the broad thrust of the reactionary right, it mind is right, except for two chapters, which are really, really wrong, because what they try to do is say that the left has no implication in certain right-wing movements that started from the left, which I thought was just... That seems to be... deliberately writing some problems out of history, but I wrote a long review on Amazon of that book that a lot of people love and a lot of people really hate. So, but I would say similar about this book. If on a 5-star system, I would give it 3.5 stars, and I'd round up to 4. You know, if we were doing that lame thing.
I'd go with 3, 3.5, but I'm with you.
I think. Yeah, I mean, like, it's interesting enough, it's good enough, and we've been harping on it for hours, but really, at the end of the day, what it critiques is real. It's just not really telling you what its answer is. And yes. And we don't expect it to be a blueprint, but I do expect a clear enough analytic for someone to be able to take this and make a blueprint.
Right.
And I don't think you get that from this book.
And the reason I'm harder on it is because I see its capacity to mislead. And I see its ability to comfort people that it shouldn't be comforting.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, like, let's go ahead and say this. You and I are both anti-workerism, right? Like,
yes, yes. Down with workerism.
And I've been told, like, over and over again, well, workerism's not the problem. Well, it seems to be pretty popular right now.
It is the problem. It's one, well, I mean, capitalism is the problem. I mean, everyone, but workerism is also...
Well, workerism is also weirdly dependent on capitalism. We've been talking about this book for, 2.5 hours, so we should stop. What's the next identity book we should read?
Let's say Fukuyama.
All right. And, hey, you want to do another show on McIntyre? I'm going to do a show on McIntyre with some Christians, too, because I actually weirdly think it's relevant.
Oh, yeah, no, that was the undercurrent to the all the philosophical stuff I was saying.
So let's actually talk about the elephant in the room, which is After Virtue, and what its relevancy is to this identity stuff. And yes. Then let's talk about Fukuyama's book on identity and see where it goes. And we'll probably lay it out over the next 2 or 3 months because I gotta reread all those books. So
we'd like to thank you for listening to today's episode. Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives are produced for Zero Books by the team of C. Derek Varn, J.G. Michael, Amog Sahu, and Toby Kamir, our ever-faithful producer and editor. Please keep following us on the Inside Zero Books Patreon account for additional episodes. Have a good day.